Hello, my name is Tiffany Pinnaman. We're here in Eatonville, Florida. It's January 31st, and I'm here with Chesha Burke from the University of Florida. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what brings you here to the Zora Hurston Festival.
I'm a speculative fiction writer. I've been writing for many years. I am here actually for the conference, the Afrofuturism Conference.
Okay, and so what inspired you to get into Black speculative fiction or Afrofuturism in general?
Okay, so I have always been interested in speculative fiction. My mother was a real horror buff, and I remember growing up listening and watching lots and lots of horror films. And from there, when I was young, you know, I just started writing. And so I was kind of one of the only kids who knew, you know, who both, you know, Vlad Dracula was, right? As well as, you know, knew, you know, kind of some of the real histories behind both speculative, you know, monsters, if you will, as well as kind of other, you know, kind of speculative figures, if you will, like monsters and things like that.
So. Okay. And so, like, in your own words, how would you define the term Afrofuturism? And, like, when you're talking to students, how do you explain it to them?
Okay. I define Afrofuturism as the site at which Black writers, right, use the speculative or somehow use the supernatural in order to reimagine a future for themselves, and they are doing so by both, you know, using Sankofa, reaching back to the past, but also they're doing that very specifically, they're reaching back to the past in order to reframe a future for themselves, right? And it's all about making sure that one has autonomy over both them, their bodies and themselves, as well as their work, right? And how it is that they can talk about and write about and imagine themselves. So that's usually how I'll talk about it.
Okay, and then what do you think it offers society? Like, is it a critique? Is it like a commentary?
Mm-hmm.
What is it to you?
I think it's all of those things. I think it's, you know, I think it's critique. I think it's commentary. You know, it's critiquing in that, you know, by a long reimagining a future, what you're doing is you are highlighting the problems that are in our present, right? And reformulating this idea around what could be possible and thus, you know, critiquing what is happening, right? So it's not just about, you know, where we lie in the future, but how do we get there and what has to change in order for us to get there.
Okay. And yeah. What are those problems that you see is like happening right now?
Well, you know, obviously, I think what's happening, you know, in just the American context, right, there seems to be a real push toward, a real push toward going backward, if you will. So the ways a lot of, you know, things happening, like with Trump being in office, a lot of the politics that are happening, but with voter registration, a lot of the ideas around, you know, women's bodies, like all of those things are being pushed, I wouldn't even say push, I'd say pull back, right? And what's happening, I think what Afrofuturism allows is for us to be able to re-examine those things, but also to be able to put a Black face on a Black face in a place that has not, you know, that hasn't existed in the past, mm-hmm. or even in the present.
Yes, and then when you think of writers like Zora Neale Hurston, Octavia Butler, but specifically Hurston, just for the sake of this conference, what does that really mean to you? How do you establish that connection between her and her Afrofuturism?
Right. I think what's really interesting is, I'm using Zora Neale Hurston in my dissertation. I think what's really interesting with her is that she was very, very much interested in looking at Black peoples throughout the diaspora, right? What is it about, you know, what is it about us? She was interested in women, of course, Black women, and she was interested very much in what is it, you know, what is it that, what are some of our samenesses? What are some of our differences? And she goes out and she does that as an anthropologist. She goes out and seeks those things. And I think that, I think that the society that we live in now makes it more possible for us to be able to bridge those, you know, those differences, those, you know, I won't even say gaps, just the ways that we exist within society as different groups, right? While we're all the same, right? Because we're all Black people, but yet we are socially, we socially function different ways. So I think that because the society, we exist in a very global society, right? Mm-hmm. We're able to, in a lot of ways, to bridge the different groups of peoples in a very similar way that she did, mm-hmm. right? And I think that her, I do see her, what would I say? I'd say I see that her uniqueness, right? Her unwillingness to accept mediocrity. Her the power that she had in just defining who she was, I think, is really foundational in the way that we see and use Afrofuturism within, you know, our work.
Mm-hmm. And then just speaking and hearing your conversations earlier on that point of unwillingness to accept mediocrity, mm-hmm. how do you see that playing in your role today as an Afrofuturist writer within the larger horror space and Afrofuturism?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think that's very important, right? Because I think horror is defined very simplistically, and horror doesn't and shouldn't, in my mind, be simplistic, right? It isn't about, it doesn't have to be about mediocrity, right? It isn't just a evil force intruding on good that has to be defeated, right? That isn't the world that Black people and Black bodies live in, right? Instead, it's very much about the world being, in a way, an evil force that works to suppress us, right? And so in a lot of ways, when Black people write about, when they write speculative fiction, they conjure an evil, you know, they conjure a presence. I won't say an evil force, obviously. They conjure a presence in order to help them deal with the reality, right? Of their existence as Black people in society. And that's very much different than what we see in horror, you know, or in speculative works. And so I think that because I think because Black people exist as a resistant force to mainstream society and mainstream ideologies, I think that offers a very unique perspective to be able to critique, of course, the society, but also to be able to do it in a way that allows the speculative and allows us to, you know, reimagine, you know, what could be and what is possible. And so that isn't in any way mediocre, yeah.
And I love what you said just about Black people being that resistant force, mm-hmm. Because a lot of times when we think about who is creating knowledge, who has the say in society, it's often like we're not the first people that are thought about.
Exactly. And, you know, we are people of resistance, right? And that is, you know, globally, like, right? We have had to resist just through our, you know, just through the fact that we exist as Black people in society, that is a resistance in and of itself, right? And being Americans specifically, you know, Americans are, in a lot of times, you know, globally, we aren't understood, right? And Black Americans aren't understood, right? But I think that one of the important things for us to understand is that Black Americans exist in a space to where, one, they're Black and so they resist on that level, but also the existence of America as a society is a resistant society, right? In order for us to, as in us, America, to exist, we had to fight for our freedom, right? And that fight along, built along with the fight of the, you know, the Black body creates what is the African American. right? And so we are, you know, a doubled, even triply resistant force within us. And so I think a lot of times it's difficult for others to understand who we are and why we're constantly battling. And I think it's because of both who we are as a group, but also who we are, you know, societally, right? Who we are as Americans.
And then in that regard, do you think that Black speculative writers have an even greater responsibility in their writing and their work?
I do. Actually, I do. I think it's very, and I know that's a burden and it's unfair. I do understand that. It's very unfair to have oppressed people have to be the people and be the ones who, you know, I think it's hard and even wrong in a way to make them responsible for their own, you know, freedom. Like there's something inherently wrong about that. But also when we live, so another idea that I have around that is that when we live in a society that is about, that does oppress us, right? It's in a lot of ways important to be able to voice and acknowledge and use the power that we have to be able to resist. Now there are, you know, there are many people who, you know, talk about and that's a conversation that's happening actually this weekend there and very recently. There are people that talk about not, you know, being tired, you know, of talking about race, and I get that. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm tired of being oppressed because of my race, right?
And Zora even said that.
Exactly.
I'm not a
race woman, right? And I think that, and I think that's where I differ from her. And I talk about it in my dissertation. I differ from her. But that being said, people should be able to voice what they want. And I'm absolutely here for that. The voices I think that are most interesting are those who do understand the position that they're in, and they use that in order to most benefit the society as a whole. Those tend to be the ones that aren't mediocre. They tend to me. Right. And they tend to be the ones that are most interesting in the ways that they can reimagine society. Right. But I don't think that we should force anyone to say or do anything or talk about or write about anything they don't want to. Mm-hmm. But I do think that I'm going to seek out the ones that are talking and doing and thinking about the things that most interest me. And that is freedom for a greater group of people.
Okay, and so when you think of this idea, what does it look like in your work? So you have Let's Play White, The Shame Crimes of Little Africa, and lots more short mm-hmm. stories and fiction. Mm-hmm. So could you speak a little bit about your own work?
Sure. So I tend to write about people and generally Black women, and also very specifically Black little girls, right? And I tend to Afrofuturism, I think, looks a little bit different when people think about my work, right? And because I write a lot of historical fiction, right? And I think when I like to think about it, I feel that I'm likely, right? I don't like to critique my work like that, but I do think that I'm likely reimagining a speculative past that offers a brighter future, right? And so when I write about little Black girls in, you know, in the South, in, you know, 1950s and 60s, I'm thinking about the ways that they themselves can function within their society that allows them a type of power that they may not have actually, you know, may not have necessarily been able to use, right? And so with that, I think that it offers not only them a different future, but it offers their children and their children's children a future that would be bright and interesting and dynamic and all of the things that sometimes we don't necessarily see.
Mm-hmm. And then just in terms of like film too, so are you influenced by film in your own writing?
Mm-hmm. I would definitely say I was. I am a huge horror buff. I'm also a huge zombie fan. Like I will watch any zombie, anything zombies, good for good or bad. I'll just watch it if it's zombies, right? I think that I try not to use the influence of film so much, but I don't think that you can kind of remove yourself from that, right? I think everything that we interact with and we see and we learn becomes a part of our work, right? And it becomes a part of who we are, and thus a part of our work. But I think that there's so many more options that are available when it comes to being able to write than what is necessarily available for film, right? And visually, there's different things happening. So a lot of times, like if I teach a film class, I'll teach it along the side of the literary work, right? And you know, you can see like there are just certain things that can be on the page that can't be on the film, and vice versa, right? So I think that the way that I write, I do imagine things in my head like a film. Like literally, you know, I imagine and I write down what I see, right, in my head. But when I'm writing it very much in a literary fashion and not in a screenplay fashion, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. But that's something that you teach yourself to do, right? So, back to the point, yes, I do love film. I love film, and I do think it's as important, and maybe even in some cases, more, because you can reach a bigger audience mm-hmm. than so what
that
you will.
Makes me think of what would a Hurston film look like?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see her. I don't know who. One, I would love to see a film about her. Mm-hmm. But it scares me what would happen to her if put on film. So I'm kind of happy that she hasn't necessarily been, you know, imagined on film. But that's also, there's also sadness there, because I don't know who could write her, mm-hmm. you know, in a way that would give her justice, because she was fantastic, right? She didn't care. Right, she mm-hmm. didn't care, and she's the one. And I think that's what's important to me about when I think about Afrofuturism, and I think about her. She defined her own terms. She defined her age. She defined where she was from. She defined how she was born, and she didn't care what other people thought about those things. She told these wild stories, even about her own past. Right, I think at one point she talks about learning to walk because of a cow or something. Right, and it's irrelevant whether or not it was true. The point is that she was able to define herself, and that's how we know her, mm-hmm. right? We know her through the stories that she tells about herself, through the words in which she described herself, right? And there is nobody else's terms by that. And that is Afrofuturism.
Would you say that she had that original black girl magic?
I would absolutely say she has that original black girl magic. I would say that she picked it up, like my dissertation, you know, would say that she picked it up, like she was black girl magic in that her ancestors were black girl magic. Her ancestors being people like, you know, the black Moses, Harriet Tubman, right? Whereas literally we are able to, you know, see someone who is, you know, speaking truth to power, right? Someone that is physically doing the work to make sure that people are free. That is resistance in a way that you don't see, let's say, that when we talk about, you know, the resistance around black bodies, we often don't get to write about ourselves, right? It's often told to us, and we're not often telling the stories, right? And we're not often using the words for which black people at the time defined themselves, right? And so someone like Harriet Tubman, who, you know, went through, who, again, you know, was willing to die for the cause that she believed in, right? Black girl magic, right? Absolutely, Zora Neale Hurston, you know, someone who defined her life by her own terms, black girl magic. It is just resistance in a way that is unwilling to acquiesce to the white gaze.
Okay. And then when you're speaking with students about Black Girl Magic, with Black Resistance, what is that process like? Do you get pushback? Are people curious?
Right. So one of the things that I think is so important in my classes, because we have to get to a point to where they're willing to accept, or at least willing to acknowledge certain things are existing, right? But then why? Why is it, like, you know, what is the purpose? Like, if we come into the class and we just start talking about Black Girl Magic, okay, so why is this a big deal, right? So it's important to define a historical context for students, right? So I do start back in the past and I look at the reasons for which Black people and Black bodies have had to resist in society, right? So what is it that slavery looked like? What was happening, you know, in the past, right? Why is it that we had resistance movements like Nat Turner, that we had, you know, resistance figures like Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, right? Who are these people, right? And, you know, what happened around these times? So once we define what history looks like for Black bodies, then we can look at what resistance looks like. Why resist in these ways and not in other ways, right? Why is it that we don't get to define the way that oppressed bodies resist? Right? What is it, you know, that this looks like for these groups of people? So, yeah.
Okay. And then when I think of that, I think of resistance as endurance as well. So mm-hmm. just the endurance of Eatonville mm-hmm. itself.
Exactly.
So how do you see just the conference mm-hmm. Continuing and furthering Hurston's legacy?
I think it seems really, really cool. I think that, the fact that, and I was unaware until relatively recently, that they have been, you know, here keeping, you know, her voice and her memories and, you know, her words and all of this alive, and just being here and watching the kids come in, right? And, you know, learning about, like, this woman, like, that many people won't have learned about, like, I think that it's amazing, right? And I think that them being able to acknowledge her, accept that, you know, she's an important figure, and also accept that her legacy is Afrofuturism, right? I think that that's just, I think it's groundbreaking. I really do. I give them much props for that.
Yes. And then I also like to talk about climate change mm-hmm. as it relates to Hurston Afrofuturism too. And so when she talked about Their Eyes Were Watching God, mm-hmm. that 1928 hurricane, that was like a real event mm-hmm. that she included in her fiction.
Right.
And so what commentary do you think she had just on our coexistence as
right.
we are facing whatever is going to happen if we don't address climate change right now?
That's an interesting question. I think that what she would say is that we're idiots, right? We just, like, I think it's important to acknowledge we don't tend to learn from our past, and we tend to repeat it consistently. And if anything is our downfall, outside of the racism, outside of the, you know, sexism, outside of the bigotry that tends to happen, I think that it is our refusal to acknowledge the things that are most evident in our lives, right? And the things that we can't, the things that we could change and we refuse to, right? And I think that the constant acceptance of, like, the constant belief that we have to accept the way things are we accept as a human flaw, but it's one that will be our downfall if we don't change it. And I think that, like, the fact that we, you know, I would connect that to, let's say, Katrina, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that, one, there was so much that could have been done to prevent Katrina, but then afterwards there was so much to be done to help people that were in it and suffering, speaks a lot about who we are as a group, as a collective of Americans, right? But it very, very much speaks about the ways in which we view Black bodies, mm-hmm. which I think is what here Zora would have critiqued. How is it that, who is it that we see, we find worthy of saving? And who is it that we're willing to leave behind for whatever reasons, right? We called our own citizens refugees, right? Our own citizens, refugees, right? In their own country. Like, where does that end?
Okay. And then just as you see in your own work, how do you see it manifesting in the real world in terms of how people can reimagine themselves, black girls, black women, and do you do any work in the community as well?
Yeah. So I think that black girl magic is, I actually support black girl magic wholly. Obviously, I'm doing a whole dissertation on it. But the reason I do is because I think that it is both coined and controlled and dictated by black women. Unlike other images, like so let's say the strong black woman, for instance, that was an image that was forced on us, right? Very often we did take it on because it's, you know, who doesn't want to be strong, right? But that is an image in which was and has been detrimental to black women, right? In that the strong black woman creates a image of a black woman that has to work for, work to maintain other people and not necessarily to benefit herself, right? And so to be strong in this regard is to be strong to the point to where you kill yourself. This is a problem. And I think that, I really hope that for Black Girl Magic, it is, because it's ran and it's controlled and it's dictated by black women, we get to decide who and what is black girl magic. There's no defining force coming in and choosing for us. Now, we have the ability of corrupting that. But I think so far, it's imagined black women as things from, let's say, you know, Michelle Obama to the everyday working mom. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody is black girl magic who puts in any type of work around both themselves and their community, right? And you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be a phenomenal, you don't have to be Serena to be black girl magic. You can just be you and I, right? And I think that's what's great about it, right? You don't have to be overly strong, you don't have to be overly weak. You can be exactly what you want to be in that moment and you still represent black girl magic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really important about it. You had a second question.
Yeah, so do you do any community work too?
So yeah, I tend to do a lot of community. So I was a CASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate. And basically I worked as a child advocate and I worked in the court system whereas the lawyer worked and did what the child wanted. Right, that was the child's lawyer's responsibility. I went into the homes, took a look at the families, took a look at what was going on, and I told the court what I thought was best for the child. And so there were two different roles. So there would be two of us sitting there, the court, you know, the lawyer who was there for what the child wanted. And it was me. I was sitting there in the court to dictate, to talk about what I felt the child needed and what was best for the child. And so I very often when I, you know, work in my communities, I also sat on the board of directors for WISCON, which is a feminist conference. Karis Bookstore, which is a feminist bookstore in Atlanta. Of course, both of those being literary, but both of them being focused on women. But specifically, my role was, and in both places, is to talk about, you know, the ways in which minority women voice, you know, to give more minority women a voice. So, okay. Yeah.
And so what can contemporary Afrofuturists learn from Zora Neale Hurston and early generations of black thinkers?
What could they learn? Oh, so much. I think, so I keep mentioning this because I think this is one of the most fantastic things about her. It's the fact that she defined herself. And I think that if we want a future, then we have to make one. Right. And I'll bring up again someone like Sojourner Truth. I will bring up people like Audre Lorde. Like, these are people that refuse to accept the image around them. Right. They spoke out when they saw injustice. They defined themselves for who they were. Right. And not it didn't let the society do that. And I think if we can learn anything is if nothing else, if you don't want to leave your house, then you don't have to do it on your terms and not on anyone else's. right? You don't have to go out and, control or run or, you know, a revolution. Just know that you have every right to exist however you choose, in whatever space you choose, wherever you choose, right? And I think that's one of the things that, and one of the most important things that we learn.
Okay. And then on that point, just like that power of language, mm-hmm. self-storytelling, self-narratives, why do you think that's so important? And do you think that we're lacking right now in terms of how we communicate our own stories?
Okay. So I think that it's important because I think that Blackness has been defined by everyone but Black people, right? And, you know, stereotypes and negative images and all of these other things. I mean, Blackness, like, if you, you know, it's really true, you know, if you look in the dictionary, Blackness is literally associated with darkness, badness, you know, and all of these negative images. And that is not something that we created, right? But it is something that we have to resist. Or not resist if we choose, obviously. But it is something that writers very often choose to resist. So I do think that's really important. And your second question was?
So in terms of the way that we can communicate our stories, do you see like any problems with the media in terms of how Black communities specifically shape and give voice to their own experiences?
Any problems?
Mm-hmm. So yesterday I did my presentation on how journalists can kind of model what Zora Neale Hurston's empathetic storytelling and gathering of stories mm-hmm. could do for just like mm-hmm. preserving mm-hmm. your story. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I argued that journalists could be more moral first mm-hmm. and they can expand the definition of what's truth.
Okay.
Because right now there's that kind of, if I didn't see it, then it's not true.
Okay.
And so how are you going to tell someone's story it's not true if you didn't? You're not that person.
Yeah, I do think that. I think one of the issues with that, like, empathy is very important, right? Like, but the problem is that it's, and statistics tend to show that it's difficult for, I won't say for whatever reason, it is, white people tend not to empathize with Black people, right? And that is across the board. And I think that therefore, when they tell our stories, they constantly tell them from the historical lens that they have been conditioned to see us. And I think that us being able to control our own stories is very important. But I think that what's happening is that a lot of times we don't have that power, right? And we don't have the, and we have to force, you know, this type of autonomy that isn't necessarily given to us, right? And so I think we're constantly going to be battling the images that they put out versus the image that versus what's reality. You know, like you said, you know, two people will see the same incident, right? And depending on the site in which they exist in the world, they will see it differently. They will see two of the same, you know, the exact same thing, and they will see it differently. And thus they, I do think that being able to rethink about what is truth, you know, how is it that we position, you know, what is truth and even reality, right? We're still working on time, you know, which we constantly consider linear, right? Reality, we think, is just what we see, you know, and very often, obviously, even when using Afrofuturism, right, it is really, you know, our idea of what is reality is very often, you know, speculative. Mm-hmm. It's very often, you know, we will hearken and think back to our ancestors. We will use, you know, the stories of our ancestors to be able to tell our children moral tales so that they learn from what has happened in the past. So I think that, you know, being able to, that's why I think that it's so important. Afrofuturism, one, is so important, but also us being able, and I think that's also a really good reason why Afrofuturism is named what it is. Very much like Black Girl Magic, it can't be taking over. Like, it is Afro. There's no line about that, right? You know, white people are not going to be writing Afrofuturism, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, us being, like, the words that we use, defining ourselves are all very, very, very powerful.
And so what did it mean to be in a collective space with the other Black speculative writers earlier
today? Yeah, it's really good. Like, it's really good being able to sit down and talk. And, you know, we talked a lot about, like, kind of the things that we've all gone through, right? It's practically a battleground, like, you know, constantly, you know, being able to try to, you know, write and publish and, you know, making sure, you know, one of the things that we haven't talked about, making sure that, like, one of the things that was really hard for me, especially in the beginning, how do I make sure that I'm not putting out reinforcing stereotypes that I don't understand that I'm doing, right? You know, and so constantly, thinking about my position, the power that I have just with my voice and my writing, right? Making sure that I'm not harming, right? I'm doing more good than harm, right? But being able to sit in a space and talk about these things with people who have also gone through it, right? Or people who have gone through it in a different way and them telling me their stories. I really do like being in spaces with writers, and very specifically Black right and women writers Black women writers that to be able just to share the time.
Okay. Yeah. And so in a space like the Hurston Festival, what legacy do you see for it and for Hurston's legacy herself, just in terms of how we can reimagine the future, what it means to have community, what it means to tell our own truths?
Okay, I'm probably going to have you tell me those again. Okay, so one, I think this legacy, I think it's just inevitable. The legacy now is, like, it won't die. Like, it won't die, and I think that's really great. I think that the town has, you know, seen to the fact that it won't and has, you know, made her, like, as important as she was, you know, and I think that's great. Like, I cannot even express how much I think that this festival, one, is important, and two, like, just seeing the children and seeing the people, and, you know, these are people that will never forget her, which means their children won't forget her. And their children won't forget her, right? She is forever here. She's inevitable, and I love it. So
the community and our telling of our own stories.
Mm-hmm. So the community, and I, like, the fact that, one, Zora defined herself and thus tells her own story, but also they get to tell her story, right? They get to keep it alive, right? And through the food, through the eating, through the sharing, through the communication, right? Through the people from all over that have come here for this. I think that that's very important as well.
Nice. And so when you think of people like Hurston, how has she influence your own work, and then what are you going to be working on in the next few years or mm-hmm. the next few months?
Mm-hmm. I think that she has, I think she's influenced me a lot. I think she's influenced me a lot, but I think that as much as my work, I think my person that she's influenced me. Like, I've said, you know, before that I like the fact that she defined herself by her own terms, and I work very hard to live my life that way as well, right? And that, you know, what you see and what you take from that is on you, right? What I present and how I feel about myself, you can't change. And I think that, I'll define everything about myself because I won't let anyone else do it. And I think that's what I take from her. And I think that I'm very happy to be able to take that from her. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm a huge fan of a lot of the ways that she existed in society. I do disagree on some things. We talked about, you know, a little bit, but the way that she existed and the way she defined herself, I would never take that from her. I would never take anything from her, but I do appreciate that. And there was one more.
So what are you going to be working on in the next few years?
I signed a contract with Rutgers University Press, and it's for a book about Storm from the X-Men. So I'm, and this is an academic book, and it's looking at Storm, and I, you know, I'm really excited about that. I'm also, I just finished a middle grade novel about two Black sisters in Atlanta. So my agent has that, and I have a have a list of things that must get done sometime in the future that some of them I can talk about, some of them I can't. Okay. So, yeah.
And so that's all from me, but thank you so much for speaking with me, Shesha, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.